you can't work in crisis and issues without, I think, and come away unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
You're working under a really tight time frame, often with incomplete information, and the key oftentimes to managing forward is to move quickly. And so sometimes you get it right. And you, of course, you do so with consultation from others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not doing it by yourself.
Sure.
You're getting input from experts and those around you. But sometimes you can make the wrong call. And I'm not going to go into specific examples because I don't want them to reflect poorly on anyone but me.
Sure.
But suffice it to say, there have been a number of times that I've thought, oh, that didn't go particularly well. And I wonder if I'm going to have a job tomorrow.
This is the Made to Advance podcast. I'm your host, Brian Olick. We're here to inspire and equip you for your best future.
Well, I am so excited for the guest we have for you today. Chris Boehner is the Senior Vice President, Chief Global Corporate Affairs Officer at Kellanova Company, formerly known as Kellogg. She oversees global communications, sustainability, philanthropy, and government relations. She designed Kellanova's pioneering Better Days program. She served as the executive sponsor of the Women of Kellogg Employee Group for 9 years. And finally, she serves on the board of Miracle Feet, which seeks to get kids with clubfoot the treatment they need. Welcome to the show, Chris Boehner.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be here.
So good to have you here, and I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Me too.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit, just so people have context as they're hearing some of your later journey, but tell us a little bit about your growing up, where you're from, stuff like that.
Sure. I am born and raised in Michigan, lived here almost my whole life. My father worked for Upjohn Pharmaceuticals, and if those who are local will remember that back in the day was based in Kalamazoo, so we lived all over Michigan growing up, moved quite a bit, and I went to school at Miami University in Oxford, mm-hmm. Ohio, lived in Chicago for a number of years, and then returned to the Kalamazoo area about 18 years ago.
And that the return to Kalamazoo was for your role at what
at
was
Kellogg,
then Kellogg's?
Yeah.
Do you say Kellogg's or Kellogg?
Kellogg.
Kellogg. Okay, well, that's good to
Kellogg's
know.
Kellogg's is the brand and Kellogg is the company.
Oh, we've learned something today. So that's good to know. And how many times have you had to explain that to someone?
A few, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, I'm curious, you know, we're going to get into some of your business journeys and whatnot, but at what age did you know I want to be in the business world? I mean, was this from a young age you had aspirations for what you're doing today?
That's a good question. I knew that I wanted to be in communications in general for a couple of reasons. All of us tend to be influenced by the people around us in our lives, and that was certainly true for me. My paternal grandfather was an honors English teacher in the Detroit area, and I really looked up to him. And he always talked about the importance of writing and, of course, literature and things. And then I had a teacher in high school, Mrs. Kennedy, who was just phenomenal, super tough, like really high standards.
Which it's funny because sometimes we think of, oh, the super tough teachers, but they actually can make a huge difference partially because they are super tough.
100%. Yeah. You want to do your best to please them, and they really push you beyond, you know, what you think you can achieve. And that was certainly true for her. And that's where I really, I think, realized, wow, I can write. And she instilled that belief in me, you know.
What'd she do to do that? I mean, how did that come out?
I just remember, again, being pushed, but also having kind of affirmation that this was a skill that, you know, that I could do in life. And then I ended up going to Miami, which has a great communications school. Yeah. And pursuing a career in the degree that I actually got, which not everybody does.
Yeah.
So I don't know that it was a childhood, you know, dream, but...
But you had enough kind of the clues to know this is the direction I need to be moving, which something in the realm of communications.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did she say anything? I have a teacher that I remember still to this day. I gave a speech, and she pulled me aside afterwards, and she said, Brian, there's you've got something here when it comes to just upfront communication. You need to pay attention to that. I still remember that little comment. That's all she said. It wasn't like this big thing. Do you have specific memories of, oh, she wrote a note on your paper or she pulled you aside and said, Or was it like she, yeah, what did she do to?
I don't remember specific phrases. I just remember her making me feel special.
Yeah.
And that I had something to offer.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, you have a part of your journey that's really unlike most people, and that is that you were born with clubfoot. And I would love for you to just kind of, clubfoot is where one or both feet are turned inwards. And I would love for you to just talk about your journey with that. And I know a little bit of it already, but it's, I mean, I don't know if treatment has changed since then, but you went through quite a journey to kind of address that.
Yeah. So I was born with clubfoot. You can have one or two. I had one. So my, you know, big toe is up on my calf. So that's how twisted the foot can be. And then I had a concomitant birth defect called spina bifida, which often come together. So from the time I was born, you can imagine probably what that was like 54 years ago for parents to, you know, realize that their child needed help right away. Mm-hmm. But from the time I was born until I was about 13, I had a lot of surgeries and treatments and casts and braces, to correct, both of those things. So, I mean, I had the really good fortune of being born in a country and to a family who could help me through that. But it's one of the reasons why I have found Miracle Feet, which you mentioned before, and serve on their board, because they're doing this amazing work in countries where if you're born with clubfoot, it is just, you know, an impact on your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
You're usually cast out of society. You're viewed as less than, and you don't have a chance. But they have these treatments now that cost very little money. And
I think I saw on their website it was like maybe $550 or something like that. I mean,
remarkable. Yeah. There's not even a need for surgery anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I had all these surgeries, and they don't even do that anymore. It's called the Ponseti method. So it's something I feel really passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that it was formative, as those types of things are usually for people, in that I hope that it has made me more compassionate and more empathetic towards others. And everyone, no matter whether you're born with a birth defect or not, has their own challenges and trials and tribulations. And so
when you were younger, you've got some limitations physically, you're having to go through surgeries.
Yeah.
How did that affect you? I mean, to me, it would feel like it would be common where somebody might wrestle with esteem issues or different things like that. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. How did it affect you being a kid having to go through this whole journey?
I think my parents were really remarkable in that way. And I never felt like braces, I walked with braces for a while. I was in a wheelchair for a short period of time. I had casts on my legs a lot. But I never felt held back in any way. I do remember, I was a cheerleader in high school, and believe it or not, so, you know, I remember feeling different, that I looked very self-conscious, that I looked different.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up getting a scholarship out of it.
Oh, is that right? For cheerleading?
No, I didn't cheerlead in college,
okay.
But I got a college scholarship for, you know, one, having been born with disabilities and yet still participating in the sport. So, I don't know. I mean, I think I credit my parents, really.
So you never sat there and thought, oh, I'm going to be limited, I'm going to be held back because of my journey with clubfoot. You just kind of took the steps you needed to take with treatment and all that and move forward, and that was that.
I think I was more resilient because of it.
Yeah, it's cool. Do you see, I know you already spoke to this a little bit, with how just having gone through that experience, how it's made you more empathetic, more compassionate. Did you already at an early age sense that you had a little bit more of, say, a burden for folks who might be dealing with unique disabilities of whatever kind, or was that something you discovered later? I think I have a special kind of calling or burden here.
I think it was later.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes when you're young, you just, you know, sort of moving through life a little bit clueless.
Mm-hmm. Did you have the compassion when you were young still?
Oh, I think so. I hope so.
But you were more aware of it as you got older.
Yeah.
When did you have a realization of, this is like a thing for me, making sure that that my life is oriented around?
I can't point to one moment, but, you know, I have a cousin who is adopted. Her name is Libby, and she has spina bifida. Mm. She didn't have clubfoot. She had spina bifida. But one of the reasons why my aunt and uncle chose her as their daughter is because they recognized that I was born with spina bifida. She's mm-hmm. South Korean by birth, and that they could help her. And I've spoken to her now as a young adult and adult. And, you know, she said, well, I looked up to you, Chrissy.
Wow.
And that was really kind of took me aback. It was like, oh, I, you know, somehow modeled something that mm-hmm. she found helpful or valuable.
That is really cool.
So that was a moment.
Yeah.
But then I think you realize as you go through life that, you know, God's given each of us gifts and that it's our job to, you know, put them in action in mm-hmm. some way. And that's why I sought out Miracle Feet, for example. Yeah. And hopefully, again, the way that you interact with everyone is impacted by your yeah. own experience.
So cool to see your example of when you take something that people would consider a weakness, a limitation, whatever, and you invite God into it to say, how does he want to use this? How can I, not just in me, but then ultimately be something that is a blessing and a benefit to other people. It's awesome. It inspires me seeing your story. I was loving, when I was looking at everything that Miracle Feet does, I thought, man, this is so cool and how fortunate they are. I know I'm sure it's a tremendous honor you to serve on their board, but how fortunate they are to have somebody who's, got your background and experience and your current day platform and skill set to be able to serve their organization. Such a cool thing. So you're serving at this high level with Kellanova, and this is a curiosity question. And I think that, you know, for I'll call us just all the people out there that benefit from work that executives do in these big companies, you think, what do they do exactly? I mean, you walk into the office and then you do stuff all day long in this multi-billion-dollar company. So take us through, and I know days can be so different, so that's where you're going to have to figure out the time period you want to pick. Take us through like the average day or average week where you're like, here's the stuff I do. What's that mean to be an executive VP at Kellanova?
Well, I think one thing for sure is that I'm blessed that every day is different, which makes it super interesting, I think, and challenging. You never quite know what's coming, mm-hmm. partially because one part of my role is dealing with communications, as you said, both proactive, the story we want to tell about mm-hmm. our company and our brands and who we are and the impact that we want to make on society, but also, you know, crisis and issues management, which every organization and company right. has to deal with, yeah. right?
And they don't, and you don't plan for those. It's never
funny.
On Tuesday yeah. we expect whatever.
Yeah. Somehow they're not on the calendar.
Yeah.
So that part can be tiring, but it's also, I know that, again, I think I have skills and abilities, God-given skills and abilities that help me through those things. One of them is the ability to stay very calm. Mm-hmm. Really, no matter what comes my way.
Well, and you're kind of energized by it sometimes.
I really am.
It's crazy. We'll be talking about what's going on, and Chris is like, oh, but I just get so excited about I'm in the news, you know, having to deal with newspaper people about, you know, things that are not necessarily yeah. always the most exciting things to deal with. So, but you're like fired up because you get yeah. a chance to step in.
The more chaotic and busy it is, the happier I am, which is a little bit sick, but I yeah. really...
You're in the right spot.
It's like I love the adrenaline. So any yeah. average day, as our youngest son, Liam, would tell you, he's like, Mom, you're just mostly in meetings.
Yeah.
But, you know, what does that mean? Well, it's you're interacting with people. So interacting with my team members, coaching, helping to problem solve, mm-hmm. You know, working through what programs we're executing. You mentioned our Better Days Promise program, which I'm really passionate about. So how are we advancing that with customers and in the marketplace and with our nonprofit partners? Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, crisis and issues, you know, interacting with a lot of different stakeholders, mm-hmm. so board members, people inside the company, media, and others. So that's where I really get energy from yeah. is that interaction every day.
How much is just sitting at your computer hammering away on emails?
I mean, quite a bit. Isn't that true for everyone?
I think it is, but I'm just like from a picture standpoint, you've got what, probably three quarters of your day face, or not necessarily face to face, but in conversation with people, would you say?
At least, yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm guessing the balance is probably being filling in on admin stuff, yeah, emails, et cetera. Is that kind of the gist of it, would yeah you say?
Is that true for you?
I think that I probably spend on a, if I did a 9-hour day, I would probably spend 60 to 90 minutes on email.
Yeah.
I would say that's kind of how it breaks out. But the only thing that's weird about my role, though, that I, when I read other people in roles that are similar to mine, is when you have to prepare a full-on weekly message, as I do, that takes a ton of time. So when I hear about other people in more CEO-type roles, the amount of time they spend in email is crazy. And
yeah,
and I don't have that level of it. I think our team kind of handles enough that,
that makes sense.
I still have good share of email, but it doesn't feel like what somebody might experience if they weren't in the role I am with a full message prep. So
yeah,
anyway,
that makes a lot of
sense.
Well,
that's helpful. It's good to have a little bit of a sense for, okay, this is what she does every day. Tell us, when you look back, you've obviously been in the marketplace for a while now. When you think, okay, these are some of the things I am just proudest of, when I look back and think I am so thankful that I could be part of that, what comes to your mind?
Two examples I think come to the fore more than anything else. One is when I first took on the philanthropy function for the company, we were giving to a lot of different causes. I mean, you can't name a cause that someone wouldn't say, well, that's worthwhile. Mm-hmm. We should give to that.
Yeah.
And what sometimes happens in an organization or a company is that you start giving to a lot of different organizations, all worthwhile, but they don't really come together against any particular focus or strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result of trying to stand for everything, you stand for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the scale and impact you want to make. So we went about a strategic process where we said, you know, what unique role should we be playing in the world as an organization? What can we do that others can't for our communities? And that's where we went about creating Better Days Promise, and what role is our food going to play? And then as I took on sustainability, you know, how are we going to think about climate and responsible sourcing, how we work with farmers and others? And, you know, how do we want to show up to our communities and make impact at scale?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that I'm most proud of, not just because of what we created then, but how it's evolved over time, over the last decade or more. And I've always said,
so it's been around for that long now.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So, wow. So when I'm, cause I saw all the different priorities it's committed to. And then like, there's this support sort of documentation where you can link on all the measures.
Yeah.
And I just thought, wow, this is a lot. And so, but it has evolved. So when I look at what's on the website right now, is that more, would you say, complex than the way it started with additions, or is it more, it's all the same elements, it's just they've been refined over time?
It's the latter, I think.
Okay.
The nugget of the idea has been the same, but we've refined and sort of integrated the work. Certainly diversity has mm-hmm. come even more to the fore mm-hmm. over the last, I would say, 6 to 8 years. And what role does diversity play in every issue you're trying to solve? Hunger, sustainability, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's been different, and also how you measure success and, you know, what kind of outcomes you're aiming to get. But I think one of the things I'm proudest of is that what started through the work of our team and a few people, and research and insights has grown to what to me is the mark of a truly impactful, impact program like this, is that everyone in the company feels like it's theirs.
Wow. That's cool.
So when you look at LinkedIn or social media, or you're walking around the halls of a building anywhere in the Kellogg world or Kellanova world now, and you see the t-shirts
mm-hmm.
and people are like super pumped up about it, and they're making choices about where they want to come to work because they want to work for a company that behaves like that. That to me is just
it's so cool. Must feel so fulfilling.
Special.
Yeah.
It is.
When you look back on, I mean, that's, you're leading some pretty radical change, and specifically with, when organizations that people are passionate about are potentially going to lose funding, support, visibility, whatever, as then Kellogg's is refining its focus, Did you experience much blowback?
Oh yeah.
I mean, if to the extent you feel like you can,
sure.
Talk about that. And the reason why I'm asking that question is because I think it's really good for any leader out there, and particularly maybe leaders who are earlier in their journey, to recognize. Right now, you can say, oh, it feels so good. People have shared ownership. They're wearing the t-shirts. This is so satisfying. We're making a big difference. But that did come at some level with a cost of persevering through what you're going to tell us about.
Yeah, it's a great insight. Because, as I said, in the beginning, we may have given to, let's say it was 20 causes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's somebody's personal passion.
Right.
And they picked that for a reason, right? And convincing people to let go of something because you're going to get a bigger outcome, not the easiest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we found, for example, we had a company match, which a lot of companies do.
Sure.
But when we delved into it, we were like, okay, well, what's the return on this and who uses it? Well, it was costing a lot of resources and money to run the program, and board members were really the people who used it.
Oh, interesting.
Really, you know, important people.
Right. Yeah.
But we
so had, when you're talking about making changes,
yes, we had
a little bit more at stake than just run-of-the-mill employees, so to speak. Here.
Yeah. And to go to them, I mean, you know, the everyday employee matters just as much, but to go to a board member and say, hey,
you know
that thing we offer you that is a perk you really like?
Yeah.
We offer it to everyone else too, but they're not using it. You are.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to make some changes, and here's why. And to their great credit, they saw where we were heading too. But at the time, it's, you know, it takes a kind of a lot of courage say, well, I'm going to take something away from you,
mm-hmm.
And convince them that where we're heading is, you know, got a bigger outcome for everyone.
And it's you that's having those conversations.
Yes, me and others, of course. But you're trying to convince people. Yeah,
yeah, that's exciting. So I think you said you had two specific accomplishments.
Yeah.
That was one of them. What was the other that came to mind?
I think more recently, the transformation that the company has undergone. You referenced our new company name. And just a brief background, we decided to spin off our North American cereal business so that we could really unleash the higher growth snacking business that we have, that's actually a larger percentage of the company's revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't go into all the details, but it's been about almost a 2-year journey, 18-month plus
wow.
journey. And I've had the privilege of helping to be part of the leadership team that led through that change. And if you think about a 117-year-old company, again, you know, trying to convince people mm-hmm. that you're going to do something bold and transformative, you're going to change the name of the company. And this is something that people hold dearly as part
sure.
of their identity.
Right.
And so my role was help to shape the story we were telling to stakeholders about why that future is brighter than where we are today. And after having been in this business for 30 years, it was pretty exciting to work on something new. I'd never done a spin before.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people have.
Yeah.
And to the chance to learn something new and to really grow personally and has been really fun and exciting.
I think, I don't know what it's like, obviously, internally, but just I read enough online and, you know, Wall Street Journal, stuff like that, where I read so many positive things. But I have to say, the name Kellanova
yeah.
is awesome. I mean, Kellogg has such a, I mean, that's just a legacy. That's a legacy brand, a legacy name. And so I'm feeling like if I'm approaching any kind of name change situation with fear and trembling, because I mean, you are on sacred territory. Yeah. And so but Kellanova, I'm like, that is good. I like it. So
thank you. That makes me feel really good.
Yeah. At the moment I heard it, I don't know if we heard it from you or from somebody else first, but I thought that works. And then I heard more of the backstory. You guys invited all kinds of company-wide input on that name change, right?
Yeah. We put employees at the center.
Okay.
They didn't necessarily choose that specific name,
sure.
but we got over 4,000 suggestions from
wow.
our employees. We did a ton of research, as you can imagine, with consumers and customers and others, because it was pretty daunting. And I always say may have been a career-limiting choice for me when I took that project on. As you said, a pretty daunting assignment. But I think by putting employees at the center, by really listening and paying attention and holding on to the things that we knew were really important to them.
Mm-hmm.
The script K, which mm-hmm. is part of our founder's literal signature, the root Kel. So, you know, it's like, this is still where we're from,
mm-hmm.
but the Latin word Nova, signaling new,
mm-hmm.
People have come to embrace it. But change is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, well, I think a couple things I want to point out just that you said. One is when you're leading change, you're committed to continually painting a picture of a better future for folks so they can see that. And I'm sure there's empathizing along the way with the things that were that they're holding on to and all that, but also trying to paint this better future. And then secondly, when it comes to actually like leading the change process and, you know, things are rolling out, it, I mean, at the end of the day, it is a journey. And I'm sure you found that, like, for all of us, when you lead change, there are going to be those who are on board right away.
Yeah.
There's that large group of people that will get there with some time and some explanation and some vision. And then there's some other folks that are maybe never going to quite be like, yes, but you have to kind of still go through with the change that you feel like you're supposed to go through with. So
absolutely.
It's cool to see you guys lead that way and lead with courage.
Thank you.
Particularly when you've been around that long. I think as a church, I think that's one of the challenges churches regularly face is they get in a comfortable place and maybe some of the forms and traditions and approaches feel not just like this is a custom, but almost feel like it's wed to something deeply spiritual in such a way that we can't even mess with it.
Yeah.
And boy, that's
sacred.
Yeah, exactly. And there are, of course, some things that are deeply sacred, but there's a lot that we have to be willing to say if it means reaching people. We got to mix it up and do new things and take risks. And not everybody's always excited about that. So, obviously, lots of great things to celebrate about your career journey. You can't get to where you are without having some more demanding experiences that cause you to have to just straight up persevere. And I'm wondering if you could just share perhaps a couple of experiences where you were like, this is really, really hard, and you're having to dig deep in order to get through it.
Yeah. You can't work in crisis and issues without, I think, and come away unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
You're working under a really tight time frame, often with incomplete information. And the key oftentimes to managing forward is to move quickly. And so sometimes you get it right. And you, of course, you do so with consultation from others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not doing it by yourself.
Sure.
You're getting input from experts and those around you. But sometimes you can make the wrong call. And I'm not going to go into specific examples because I don't want them to reflect poorly on anyone but me.
Sure.
But suffice it to say, there have been a number of times that I've thought, oh, that didn't go particularly well, and I wonder if I'm going to have a job tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I know for sure is that each of us, all of us, will make mistakes in our jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And many mistakes. But one of the things that I think I feel really blessed about is that I have the good fortune of having built really strong relationships, having been with the same company for almost 18 years. Mm-hmm. And when I made missteps, or what I perceived as missteps, people around me had my back.
Yeah.
They gave me the benefit of the doubt. And I hope I do that for others
sure.
as well.
Yeah.
But to me, that makes a huge difference. And then, of course, the importance of reflecting on the mistake that you may have made or the misstep. What could you have done differently? Talking about it. And we have a value called humility and hunger to learn. You know, what did you learn from that? And so that you don't necessarily repeat it again. But
when you realized that a mistake had been made, how did you lead the process on, I'm going to talk with whomever I need to talk about and say, hey, I think, and maybe some of them are super self-evident, or maybe some of them you realize over time, but are you the first one in the office, so to speak, saying, hey, I want to own the part of this that's mine. I want to, or are you waiting for someone to come to you? How does that work?
Oh, always stepping forward first, I think is important.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in the situations I'm describing, it's blatantly obvious because the measurement stick is the media coverage.
Mm.
It's not like it's a big secret. You know, it's like the story that's being told isn't very favorable.
Mm-hmm.
Or there might be, you know, calls for a boycott or things like that that happens to organizations.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of the things you face of being a public company or any organization is, as you said, not everybody's going to agree with you. And sometimes, you know, we live in a country of free speech. You can say whatever you want to in social media now and of course, more traditional media. So it's usually, you know, pretty clear if things aren't going our way. A lot of that is out of my control or anyone else's, but I think stepping forward immediately in any situation that's not going the way you planned and saying, this isn't going the way we thought it would, and quickly pulling a team together, of course, taking accountability, but being focused on solutions and how you're going to get through it together.
It's cool your team, and you would hope any good team is like this, is willing to extend grace, benefit of the doubt, et cetera. In this whole cancel culture situation that we're in, it feels like sometimes if there's a mistake made or whatever for even the best intentions, man, it just feels like it's a rush to judgment situation. And that's just not healthy. And I don't know. I mean, it's a great, you know, as you're talking, it's a great word to even folks who might be on the other side of changes in their own world or their own organization to say, we don't get it all right. And we know that there are all kinds of circumstances. You're doing the best that you can with what you have. And afterwards you go, okay, sometimes it went the way you hoped, sometimes not. But and of course, if a person makes decision after decision that it was where they led to bad outcomes, well, that's a different conversation. But when you see a track record of somebody who makes good calls, I think the rest of us have to say, let's kind of get through this together and recognize this is just part of what comes with leadership. Sometimes I'll see leaders who they, especially if they're earlier, they drop the ball on something or fail in some big way, and it just feels like a life is over situation. And I think every young leader in particular ought to just know you are going to have catastrophic failures. You're going to have moments you're so, I mean, maybe they, or at least they feel catastrophic to you. There, it's embarrassing. It's, you know, it may end up that you lose your job. And it may be that is precisely what you needed to get to your next best thing. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, what else were you going to share when it came to difficult things?
Oh, I mean, those are probably the primary examples that come to mind. Like I said, there have been many, you know, nothing catastrophic.
Yeah.
But I think I did come to a point, you made a really important point about you might lose your job. And there was a part of me for a long time, like that was the worst thing I could think of that could happen to me, especially when I was the sole breadwinner. Mm-hmm. And that was like my worst fear. And I finally came to realize, so what?
Yeah.
Like I'm not going to do anything to affect that outcome. I mean, you know, I don't want that outcome, but what if it did happen? Well, Angela Duckworth, I don't know if you've read this book called Grit.
I've got the book, haven't read it.
It's so good. I really highly recommend it. But she talks about, you know, so much of what matters in life is, you know, sort of not what happens to you, but sort of the perseverance that you show to keep moving forward through it. And if you think about, you know, each of our lives and what we faced, you know, oftentimes the mark of someone who's successful is the one who had the grit to keep moving forward.
Yeah, one foot in front of the other. Well, I think that when it comes to even thinking about facing a fear, let's say like losing your job or whatever, we do these things that we get in these headspaces where we've got this thing we're afraid of, and then we end up leading or living out of a place of fear.
Yeah.
And the truth be told, there are very few things that you can't come back from. I mean, so if you just go, I'm going to do the thing I'm called to do, and I'm going to be true to that, and I'm going to name the worst case and go, you know what? Mm-hmm. We can make it through that.
Yes.
I've had to do that many times over the years where we're, you know, starting in Getty where we had to say, worst case scenario, we're living in our parents' basement. That's the worst case. And you know what? We'll be okay.
Yes.
We'll find a job after that. So that's a good word. Tell me about how your faith and just relationship with God has affected your work. You've kind of spoken to that a little bit already, but anything else come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know from our conversations, I was a bit of I would call myself a late bloomer in the faith department. Mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly grew up in a Christian household. You know, my parents had us baptized as infants. We went to church, but it was more like an Easter and Christmas kind of thing.
Sure.
It wasn't, I don't think, part of my education per se. And then my first husband was agnostic or atheist. I'm not sure which label is the right one, but not a believer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that had an effect on me, stifling effect.
Yeah, sure.
A big one. And so even though I had ideas about you know, my own belief. I didn't pursue them. So it wasn't till later in life that I really kind of opened that door and have, you know, I think grown quite a bit mm-hmm. since then. So from a work perspective, I have found that I try to hopefully lead with authenticity and compassion and empathy and the way that I show up being a demonstration of yeah. my beliefs, number one. Number two, in conversation where it makes sense, being open about my own faith yeah. in a way that's organic mm-hmm. and authentic. So, you know, what did you do this weekend? Well, we hosted a couple small group mm-hmm. and we're studying this really interesting book by Ortberg and, yeah. you know, and they say, well, tell me more a little bit about that. And so that can be a door opener. But, you know, I think sometimes in the workplace, particularly a public company or large organization and you're an executive, I feel certain sensitivity about not wanting to be seen to be proselytizing.
Right, for sure.
So I try to strike the right balance of being sharing who I am, genuinely who I am and what I believe. And so that's kind of how I have chosen to show up.
Yeah, I think that is such a great example. I talk to folks who are, and not even in a public, public company kind of setting, where I feel like because they're so afraid of even potentially crossing a line with talking about something that might make somebody feel uncomfortable or whatever, they've just said, listen, work is work, and my relationship with God is personal. It will not show up at work. I'm not going to bring it up, et cetera. And I mean, it is just walled off. And man, that breaks my heart a little bit because I feel like when you wall off your relationship with God, you are then saying, I'm just walling off really one of the most important parts of my life. That being said, obviously being sensitive is so important to where people are at and to one's leadership responsibilities and such. So I love that idea and example of just saying, hey, relationally, as I know a person, as it's natural to talk about my journey in a personal way, then I'll give voice to it and I'll not be afraid to name that. And obviously I know with you and Craig, you also have all kinds of people and causes that you care about. Yeah. And so you're making an impact in all kinds of ways that go beyond, you know, the day-to-day of work. What led you to, you know, have with the journey as you described it, what led you to say, I want to pursue spiritual life, relationship with God more intentionally? Was that I've moved on from a marriage where that was not a big value, or what was the thing?
The biggest catalyst was my husband, Craig.
Yeah.
Because of his faith, and I just so admire everything about him, and it's a big part of who he is. And from the moment we met, I knew that about him, and, you know, I've just learned so much from him and wanted to learn more. I just was intellectually curious. Yeah. And spiritually curious.
Yeah, that's cool. We love Craig. we're both big Craig fans here. You said it would be okay for me to press into this area. That's a personal area a little bit. So let's talk about your first marriage. That had some really, really challenging dynamics. And I think that, honestly, I think people would see you on the outside. They know what you're doing with your life, all that. They think, oh my goodness, she's living the dream, this kind of thing. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what your first marriage was like.
Sure. We were together almost 25 years, so dated for almost seven, married 17, and, you know, had the joy of having a son together, had a good life together. But over time, it became apparent that he had an addiction issue. Mm-hmm. He was becoming an alcoholic. I don't know when, you know, you finally realize that someone can't let go of, of something and has substance abuse issues, but it became apparent to me over time. And increasingly apparent, not just by his behavior and how much he was drinking, but how he was treating me. Mm. And so as his drinking increased, he began to be abusive. And it was psychologically and verbally abusive. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where it was truly frightening.
Wow.
And by this point, we had a son. And so I just, you know, there was a number of years where it was truly in crisis. And he would admit he had an issue but wasn't willing to get help. Mm. We were in marital counseling, you know, really seeking to try to solve for this. But it wasn't getting better. It was getting worse.
Yeah.
And I kept sticking it out because I thought that was the best thing for our son, who's autistic. Regardless of that, I think I would have made the same choice. But I thought, well, this is what I need to do. And I also, quite frankly, got to the point where I was, I would call it frozen with fear. Here I am. I'm educated. I have a good job. I have resources. I was the sole breadwinner, as I said. I have a very close family. I have good friends. Mm-hmm. They were starting to point out the issues.
Wow.
And yet I didn't have a plan to get out. You know, I kept hoping it would get better.
Mm-hmm.
He would say, I promise you I'm going to stop drinking. It would get better, a little bit better. He would treat me a little bit better. I'm so sorry. All the classic hallmarks of substance abuse and, domestic violence. And I see that now in retrospect, but you can't see it when you're this far away mm-hmm. from it. But it finally got to the point one day, I don't know why I had had enough, but he'd been drinking and I knew he was going to be coming home and I knew what was in store for me that night. And I was really dreading it. So I went for a walk in the neighborhood. And I walked to the steps of the chapel where we had been married that was less than a mile away. And I sat on the steps of the chapel and I prayed to God, what is it you want me to do?
Hmm.
I am at a loss. I do not know what to do. And I heard from him very clearly, it's time to go.
Hmm.
And I made a really tough choice that day. I went home and I packed a bag. And our son was in the house, and I knew that my ex-husband was going to be home soon. I left without my son. And I'm sure a lot of people who listen to that would think, how could a mother do that? I was afraid of being accused of kidnapping. Mm. I was afraid of what he would do coming after me because of what had happened. And so I left and thought, I'm going to need to file for divorce and file for custody. And it was quite a long journey. A long journey. I will tell you that even when the divorce was final, I had custody Tuesdays and Thursday evenings and every other weekend.
No kidding.
That was it.
And I assume through the whole legal process, they understood he was dealing with substance abuse issues, or did that not come
up?
Yeah,
it came up, but I had filed for restraining orders and all sorts of things, and the legal system makes it very hard mm-hmm. to navigate those situations. And
how tough that must have been for you to know why you were leaving, and then to be able to see your son so relatively infrequently.
Yeah. In the end, we ended up getting full custody, mm-hmm. and tragically, my ex-husband passed away, died of alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
And that is a tragedy. He was a good man.
Yeah.
He was a really good man, and he suffered from a disease and never got help for it. But that's my journey, and I've tried to be open about it and vulnerable about sharing that. I've shared it in the workplace with the Women of Kellogg organization, and it's remarkable how many people respond, I too have been there. I too have gone through that. Thank you for sharing your story.
Did you worry about, and thank, I was just thinking earlier, I just want to say thank you for sharing and being willing to just put it in front of people, because that's the thing. I fear sometimes people are dealing with things at home or behind the scenes that they know are not right, but they're so afraid to bring it into the light. And difficult, painful, damaging things absolutely flourish when it's all a secret and behind closed doors. And so I just am so, that's another expression of courageousness to be willing to share it. When you were sharing it, did you feel the first time this is such a huge risk, et cetera, or was it this? It's time, and I'm not worried about putting it in front of people outside.
No, I still worry. I worry to this moment. I worry about the impact it will have on our son, although he witnessed it. I mean, he's 20 now, and he witnessed. He knows exactly, you know, the great things about his dad and the things his dad struggled with. So, you know, I'm not telling a secret he doesn't know. But it is difficult because you don't want to hurt the people around him and the people that are part of his life. And yet, as I said, I do know it's a disease. He needed help. Unfortunately, he never accepted that help. And I wish that he'd gotten it. And so, you know, we have to talk about these things. It happens, domestic violence, alcohol abuse or drug addiction or all those different types of things, mental health challenges, happens in every household. It can happen in every household. It doesn't matter, you know, who you are, equal opportunity pain. And so I think it's important to talk about it. And those are things we have to get through.
Is there anything that you would say to someone who who's in an abusive situation right now and that would be somewhat similar to yours? I mean, and I say similar to yours, if somebody is physically being being abused, that it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on this. Maybe you wouldn't put those in different categories. To me, if you're being physically harmed, you need to get distance ASAP. I think what's tricky, and this is where I'm actually going with this question, what's tricky is when it's not so obvious. If there's not somebody strikes somebody else, that's one thing. But when it's emotional and other kinds of manipulation and abuse, you're in a really tough spot. When is the time that you say it's too much? There's not some scale out there, to my knowledge, that says this is when you take a step. And I appreciate what you were doing with persevering and then saying, I want to discern, and ultimately saying, I want to hear from you, God. But if somebody's in that situation right now, what would you say to them about the journey? And they're saying, oh, do I keep fighting for this relationship? Do I need to step away? When's the right time? I don't know what to do. What do you say to them?
For sure, getting counseling, getting professional help.
Even if their spouse wouldn't go.
Yeah, go yourself.
Yeah.
And I also think talking to experts, domestic violence experts, what I would say, again, in hindsight and from what I've read, is that it escalates. It tends to escalate over time. And that's certainly what was my experience. And if you are feeling fear, listen to your fear.
Something needs to change.
Something needs to change. So, you know, I think an expert might have been able to help me. I was seeing a counselor, which I think is really important, but I still didn't know how to get out. And like I said, I think the common denominator that I've read over and over again is that people hope it's going to get better because you love that person.
You
want it to get better. Isn't that what you don't go into a marriage thinking, I'm going to give up.
I think that what you're saying is really good. If you invite outside input, then maybe somebody can give you a little bit what feels like somewhat of an objective, here's what I'm experiencing, and they can speak in and say, you're to that place. This is more than just working through marital difficulties here. And then it's just not all on you. I guess, did you end up having that kind of input before you finally made the decision, or was it still it was after that you realized, oh, maybe if I would have perhaps heard some different kind of input, I would have realized we're to that place. It's time.
Yeah. I think one of the really difficult things, and this is hard, I think, for people to understand, is I felt like I deserved to be treated that way. That you get to a point where you think, you're right, I am not worthy. You start to believe what someone's telling you. And so, you know, who am I to think that, I should go anywhere? This is where I should be.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the truth of the matter.
Yeah, so your thinking is so broken inside.
Yes.
That you're no longer perceiving reality.
I think that's what happens.
How long did it take you to feel like to restore and heal your own thinking from that? And maybe it's still a journey. I don't know. But
I would say still a journey.
Yeah.
still a journey. I mean, I'm in a much, much healthier place now. But, you know, my self-confidence was definitely took a huge, you know, had a huge impact on my self-confidence.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would urge someone to get help from professionals, listen to your instincts. Yeah. Yeah.
It's hearing you share all that. That is such a good reminder to all of us too. When we're interacting with people at work or wherever, we just never know what they're going through.
Absolutely.
And to be caring and empathetic and patient, mm-hmm. because you may have, I mean, you have no idea what's going on at home, and nobody would have looked at you and thought this is what's going on when you leave work, and you're up, you're motoring, you're doing your best to put your game face on and do your job, and so thankful, I'm sure, for the team that was around you at that time that didn't even know what was going on. So thanks.
I had one person who knew what was going on at okay. work, my assistant, because she would see me in tears every day.
Yeah.
And at the time, we had offices with doors.
Oh, gotcha. So you could be a little more private.
Yeah. But then, you know, you're in meetings all day, like we were talking about. And so I would break down in tears. And then she would say, do you need a few minutes? Mm-hmm. And then she would help with me. I mean, what a godsend. Mm-hmm. But I could not agree with you more. Everyone's going through something. And so the need to, you know, demonstrate compassion and to assume positive intent.
Mm-hmm.
Seldom when someone lashes out at you, is it about you?
Yeah, boy, that's a great word.
Right? And so, you know, trying to let that wash over you. But then also, I'm reading this book that's so powerful. It's by David Brooks, and it's called How to Know a Person.
Oh, Brooks is a great...
Isn't he?
Oh, he's a great author. I haven't read that book, but he is fantastic.
Oh, I highly recommend it. Yeah. I cannot stop talking about
it. Put it in the show notes, yeah.
The subtitle is How to... the art of deeply knowing or deeply seeing someone and being deeply seen.
Wow.
And it's just super powerful. But, you know, not just letting someone's pain go by you and not taking it personally, mm-hmm. but seeking to understand if someone's lashing out, are you okay?
Yeah, which is so counterintuitive as a move to make because you, instead of... If you lash out on me, I'm going to be prone to go on the defensive, or attack back. One of the two. What human nature is not to do is to think, how is this person feeling? That's leading them to speak the way they're speaking, and then to ask that courageous question and see if it can go to bigger places. Have you tried that yet?
I mean, yes. I say that with caveat because you're right. I think it's really hard to do. But one of the things he says in this book is, and it's a truism that no doubt you've heard before, pain that's not transformed is transmitted.
Boy, that's good.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how can you, if you really want to deeply connect with someone, then seeing past this, you know, anger or you know, rudeness or mm-hmm. what have you, and saying, well, this person's really struggling mm-hmm. with something. And either letting it go if the moment is right, seeking to understand, I think, is something that I would like to do more often.
Yeah, that's good. That's what I try when I see somebody really, really worked up about a situation that feels like it's important, but it just feels like your reaction is disproportionate to the situation at hand. You know, I've tried to just ask exploring questions at times, and this is on my best days. And so there's lots of times that doesn't happen.
Yeah, right.
There's lots of times that all I can think of is I am ready to have some words with you for having words with me. But to be able to say, hey, obviously this is a big deal to you. Help me understand what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, just that kind of an open-ended question and sometimes it's a circle back to it too, because sometimes in the moment,
it's not the right moment.
Yeah,
for it. Yeah,
yeah. And you address the issue right in the moment, and then later on, like the next day, even just saying, "Hey, let's circle back there." You've got we're gonna have all kinds of younger leaders, aspiring leaders, listening to this conversation, and this is such a broad question. But when you rewind the clock to when you were just getting started, is there anything that just feels like this is a word of encouragement that you would give to someone who has big hopes, big dreams, but also thinks, man, I'm just on the front end of this journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I see now is what I would share. I didn't know this then, but, you know, the way to make a big impact is through small moments. And it's through what we were just talking about, which is the kinds of connections you have with the people around you every day. And I love the idea, and I believe it, that the legacy we have in our careers is not going to be about the titles or the compensation mm-hmm. or accolades or what have you. It's going to be about having deep connections with people mm-hmm. that and the impact that you have on those around you. You know, certainly when you think about someone's celebration of life at the end of their life, their funeral, you know, they're not going to be like, yeah, Bob was a heck of a CEO.
Right.
You know, it was yeah. like, well, he was a good man, and mm-hmm. and this is the impact he had, and this is what he said to me, those mm-hmm. little moments. You know, like we were talking about our teachers and the impact that they had yeah. on us from those just little encouragements. So I think that when you're early in your career, focusing on working hard, right? I mean, it's pretty simple. Yeah. Like yeah. do what you were asked to do. Do it to the best of your ability. If you don't know what you're doing, for goodness sake, ask for help.
Oh, my goodness. Amen.
Right? Ask for help, because none of us come out into the yeah. workplace knowing what we're doing. Like, that's, you know, just ask lots of questions. Be mm-hmm. intellectually curious. And really think about the relationships you're building mm-hmm. and be kind to everyone that you meet. And from a really pragmatic standpoint, I would take notes on everyone I interacted with. I wish I had done that.
I was
going to
say, you do it now. Okay,
I do it
gotcha.
Now. Yeah. I've done it in recent years. And, you know, Craig can tell you, I will often go back to my phone because yeah. I want to know.
Is that how you knew all my kids' birthdays? Because you were so good at taking those notes.
I yes.
Like, she is killing me right now
yes.
knowing all this. Yeah.
Yeah. But like taking note of the things that matter yeah. to the people who matter to you.
Yep.
And then remembering that, you know how good that feels when
yeah,
somebody
that's right.
plays that back to you and says, oh, I see you.
Yeah. Well, it's such a good, your comment about building into relationships. And you know, the thing is, it doesn't need to be this massive thing. The
yeah.
other day, I had a staff member who's stepping into a new role, and she shared with me that my daughter-in-law texted her when she stepped into the new role and just said, hey, I'm really excited for you. I want you to know I'm praying for you. I
yeah.
think you're going to do great. That meant the world to
exactly.
her.
Exactly.
And she's sharing it with me and with the rest of our staff, even though it was just a small text. I remember once Justin and I were at a director's retreat, and of course there are many times I probably should have sent a text or should have said an encouraging word and didn't. But that being said, in this particular conversation, one of our directors was referencing some texts that I'd sent to her and then to a couple of other people. I don't even remember them,
right.
to be honest. I once she started talking, it started vaguely. But for her, it was the right word
yes,
at the right time.
Moment.
It did not take me an hour and a half
yeah.
to do. It took some compassion and being aware and then saying, I'm not just going to sit with it. So anyway, I think
yeah,
that's
such
a great
word. Yeah, you were others focused.
Yeah.
I had an example that I was sharing just yesterday. I got a note from someone that said, a project wrapped up, and I had reached out to them and said, thank you so much for your leadership on this project. It was a partner mm-hmm. From outside the company. And she wrote back and, you know, said, thank you. It's been fun to work together. And just want you to know what an impact what you did for such and such made. And I thought to myself, who is this? I don't recognize this name. What did I do? And as more I reflected on it, I remembered it was a moment in a meeting where there was a huge group of people around a very large table. And, you know, we were talking about important things, I guess. And this young woman walked in late, and she looked around and tried to figure out where to sit. And she sat around the perimeter of the room. And I looked at her, and there was an open spot at the table. And I said, came over to her and said, why don't you come sit at the table?
Wow.
I didn't know her.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really think about it. But I thought she didn't look like she knew that she belonged. And she deserved a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And apparently, like you said, that was the right thing at the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about it
yeah.
at all. I had to reflect later.
Yeah, right. But my guess is that's going to fit her, for her in the category of things she needs. If she needed or felt like it was appropriate to take the time to say explicitly thank you like that, that memory is probably going to be rooted in her for the rest of her life when she is increasingly in places of influence and other circles where she's like, I remember what Chris Boehner did for me and I want to be that person. Is there anything else, Chris, that you feel like you'd like to share just things you've been thinking about or processing that you think would be good for those who are listening?
I think what I would share is that based on the stories that I've told and that I know every single person has to tell, is that we will all go through difficult chapters in life. And thinking about those difficult chapters as either opportunities for pain and internal, you know, suffering, or an opportunity to propel you and the others around you forward. You know, how are you going to use that moment to be more empathetic, more understanding, to be more connected to the people around you? To me, that's a really powerful idea because we're not going to escape
right.
troubles. But how do you transform that into something that's positive?
And wouldn't you say that's always such a choice? I mean, it feels like probably the default is I'm just going to be hurt and bitter by those things. So it feels to me like you really have to be intentional and say, I am going to let this be something that is positively transformational in my life and for the life of others. Do you feel like you've gotten to a point where you make that decision out of instinct now? I mean, having made it many times, was it ever, I am going to choose this, or were you just wired that way?
Look, I think we all have our moments where we're not our best selves. Certainly true for me. Mm-hmm. And where the pain that you're going through comes out in a way that's unproductive and unhelpful for the people around you. Mm-hmm. So I am not purporting that, you know, through all of my trials and tribulations that I've, been a saint by any stretch. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone is.
Right.
But I hope that on balance that I have found it in me to take a beat.
Yeah.
And think about how I want to show up.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Well, I am so appreciative of you being here today. And I feel like, Chris, your example as a leader is just so inspiring, so encouraging. I don't know what people think of when they think of someone who is living and leading at your level. But what is so cool, having had a lot of time to get to know you, is, and I find this is honestly true with a lot of people in great leadership positions, is you get to know you and you're like, you care for people. You want to be there. You want to do your job well. You're really good at some stuff, and that's why you're doing your job. But it is so much more in your life than just being really good at some stuff. You care deeply for those around you, and I'm sure your team feels it, and it feels incredibly fortunate and thankful to be on your team. But I know Christina and I sure do, as we count it a huge privilege to be friends. So thank you for being on today.
Thanks
for sharing your heart.
It's been my privilege. Thank you, Brian.
I'm so thankful that we could have that conversation with Chris. I just love her example that despite some pretty significant limitations in her early childhood, she didn't let any of that hold her back from living into her full potential. And I love how even as an adult, when she was going through very difficult and even potentially dangerous situations as a grown woman, that she now is saying, how can I use those difficult experiences to build into the lives of others? Man, I hear Chris's story and I'm like, I hope I can have the kind of leadership and interpersonal courage that she does. This has been another great conversation today. And I hope that if this has been a interview that's been helpful to you, please help us get the word out. Review, rate this podcast, share it with others. Let some friends know about what you heard today. This has been an Getty Church production, and we're so excited to bring to you more great content week after week. Until then, just know you were made to advance. Mm-hmm.